Time for us to begin this morning. So glad for you to be here and interest in studying these Old Testament texts. I've said many times, not everyone shares my interest in this portion of history, but it's exciting to me. And there are many lessons to be gleaned from the period of the kings. And so we want to study this morning, as we continue the study of the kings, just a little bit about Josiah. I know that Wednesday night we talked about Josiah quite a little bit, and we want to talk just a little bit more and conclude some thoughts, summarize some things about Josiah, and then move on and talk about his son Jehoahaz. And so we'll discuss that from 2 Kings chapter 23. But right now, if you would please open your Bibles to 2 Chronicles chapter 33. Now, one of the things that we're trying to do, and I hope that you see that in your lesson book, is to follow the text that deals with the king that's being discussed. If you start reading in the book of, of 2 Samuel, and just keep reading right on up through 2 Kings, you'll get the story, but you'll omit a great deal that's covered also in the Chronicles. So what I would like for you to do is to read about the kings, what this writer has to say and what this writer has to say, and get all the details you can get about that particular king and his reign, and then move on to the next one. And what we're trying to do is to bring them down consistently down the page that you see in your set of maps, now on page 115 through 118, part number 3, on the chart of the kings. And I think if you'll study it that way, it will be the most helpful to you. What I've tried to do in the presentations on the board is to put in red up at the top of each slide the passage that becomes the dominating passage, as it were, whether it's the Chronicles or the Kings, the one that gives us the most information, and then occasionally we'll go back into the other one and pick up a point or two that may be omitted from the account that we're reading. What we want to have is the fullest picture that we can of the works of these kings and their reign. And so that's the purpose, and that's the reason for my madness, as it were, in presenting it in this way, and why I would like for you to study it in that way. I think you'll glean the most from it if we do. To go back and pick up a thought or two about Josiah. When we look at young Josiah, we see that he became king at the ripe old age of 8 years old. He began at 16 years old to seek after God. At 20 years old, we see the beginning of numerous reforms as he purges the region of idols. And then at 26 years old, he sets in order the things that are necessary to repair the temple. Now, we see that in 2 Chronicles chapter 34 in the account of the Chronicles. One of the things that we discussed in some detail in our study on Wednesday night is that during the time of the repair of the temple, the book of the law was found, the law of Moses. We're going to talk about that, by the way, in the sermon this morning. And Josiah reads, strangely enough, the book of the law. And what generally happens when you read a set of instructions and you've got a way of doing things on your own, and you read the instructions and you find out some things that perhaps you've been doing wrong. Now, all of us have done that when it comes to reading instructions. We want to lay the instructions aside, and then we want to do it our own way. And then we find out that don't work, and then we pick up the instructions and see where we went astray. Well, for a period of time, the book of the law has not been being read. Now, according to the law of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 7, or 31 rather, that was to be read every 7 years. In the ears of everybody, the children, the Israelites, as it were, their children, sojourners that were in the land, so that they could know what God's law was. But obviously at this point it's not been being done. And we see that in the northern kingdom certainly it's not been being done, because since the days of Jeroboam, they've been worshiping and serving idols. All the northern kings have been bad, and we find now that the northern kingdom has been taken captive by the Assyrian Empire. And now we're studying the remaining kings in the southern kingdom. And as we talk about Josiah and the reading of the law, he discovers there is just a whole lot of things that we're not doing right. And so he assembles the people and has the law read publicly to the people. And they observe there's a lot of things we've not been doing right. And so Josiah sets about to reform these things that are wrong. Now, one interesting thing, we made this observation in our study Wednesday night. The prophetess Huldah, she informs Josiah that because of the good things that you have done, evil is going to come upon these people. They'll be destroyed, but you'll be dead. You won't see that happen. And so that was to be the reward or the blessing that was to be Josiah's because he had tried to turn things around. And to some degree, at least, had been successful. We saw that he destroyed even the high places in Jerusalem that Solomon had built for his heathen wives. You remember we talked earlier about this from 1 Kings chapter 11, how that the kings were not to multiply wives. And we saw that Solomon did that very thing. And not only did he multiply wives, how many wives did he have? 300 wives and 700 concubines. I sometimes get those numbers reversed. 300 wives and 700 concubines. Quite contrary to what God had told him to do. And the reason that God told him not to do that and told kings not to do that is you will begin to worship the gods of the women that you've married. And that's precisely what King Solomon did. And now we find that years later, here comes Josiah, one of his descendants, and destroys the altars that King Solomon had built for his heathen wives. Now, moving along as we talk about Josiah, we know that there has been the introduction by Jeroboam, the first of the kings of the northern 10 tribes, to institute calf worship. And that's been a problem for many of the kings, even some of the southern kings. They worshiped these golden calves. And one of the things that we see that Josiah did is he destroyed the shrine to the golden calf at Bethel, fulfilling just exactly what was prophesied in 1 Kings chapter 13, verse 1. I'll call your attention to that. Yes?
It was 700 wives.
700 wives? I did turn it around. I do that every once in a while, and then I can't get it right. But I appreciate that. 700 wives, 300 concubines. All right, thank you. It was, yeah, more than one was too many. So, yeah, that's exactly right. 700 wives and 300 concubines. If I say that enough, maybe I'll remember it next time. But in 2 Kings chapter 23, beginning in verse 17, we read about him destroying the shrine that was built to the golden calf at Bethel, just exactly like had been prophesied in 1 Kings chapter 13, by the young prophet, you remember, in that instance. Yes?
One thing I had forgotten about the prophecy in 1 Kings 13 is that Josiah is called out by name.
Is that interesting? Very good observation. Called out by name. Now, mathematicians in the family, put some dates on that. When we know that the kingdom divided about 931, 32, long in through there, when Rehoboam reigned, and then you look at your chart and see when Josiah reigned, when he did this, and we can get an approximate idea of about when, how long it took for this prophecy to be fulfilled. Now again, some of you mathematicians in the family, you work on that for just a moment, and you only have a minute to tell us about how long that was. From 1 Kings 13 to 2 Kings 23. But it is an interesting observation. Hundreds of years have passed. An interesting observation. Here are the prophets during this period of time during which Josiah is king in the southern kingdom. And much of what we want to look at this morning in our study is going to come from the book of Jeremiah. Now remember that Assyria was in the process of falling. God had used the Assyrians to conquer the northern 10 tribes. We studied in Isaiah chapter 10, I believe it is, beginning about verse 5, or is it verse 1, I believe. And then it begins to talk about the fall of Assyria, verse 5. But in that context, it's discussing how that God would use the Assyrians as the instrument of His wrath. Look at that very carefully. The instrument of His wrath to pronounce judgment upon those of the northern kingdom who were worshiping idols. But what about the Assyrians? God would punish the stout heart of the king of Assyria, who began to claim that all of these accomplishments he had done. And he was going to use the Babylonians or the Chaldeans to do just that. Everything now falling in place just as God had said. Now, Nahum. Can someone tell me what the book of Nahum is about? Some time ago I had a study with some folks, and what we were doing was just going through the books of the Bible and just in a brief statement or two describing what was in each book, which is not a bad thing to do, to familiarize yourself with what the book is about. Nahum, there's one theme of the book of Nahum. What's he discussing?
You've been educated, you have to say judgment. Judgment?
Judgment upon Nineveh. Yes, judgment upon Nineveh. Now, those of you familiar with our map, what's the significance of Nineveh?
Capital of
Syria. That's right. So you see how that Nahum fits in this time frame of Josiah. Actually, he would prophesy just preceding, just at the same time frame that Josiah is reigning in the southern kingdom, that Assyria is going to fall. Nineveh is going to fall. And Nahum discusses that in great detail, which, another point, side note here, doesn't cost any more, from the book of Nahum is to note that the Assyrians were under law to God, and they were not under the law of Moses. And Nahum says there's judgment coming upon the Assyrians, particularly the city of Nineveh. And of course, the book of Jonah fits well with that too, to help us to see that as Jonah was to cry out against the Ninevites, it was because of their sin. If they did not repent, they would be destroyed. And ultimately, you see, they were destroyed, not at the time of Jonah, but later. They were destroyed as they had been used to punish God's people. Now God is using the Chaldeans to punish them. Any question or comment just here? Josiah reigned for a long time, about 31 years. We've noted in our study Wednesday night, and forgive me if I'm going over this material too hurriedly. I know some of you were not here Wednesday night, but I want you to be familiar with this. We know that a part of Josiah's reforms involved the burning of the bones of men upon the altars devoted to these idols. And why would he do that? What was the purpose of burning men's bones on the altars of these idols?
Desecrates the altar.
Desecrates the altar. That's right. It defiles it so it can no longer be used.
You asked about the length of time.
Yes.
Between Jeroboam and Josiah.
Yes.
Or Rehoboam. The division. So it's 300 years.
300 years. Isn't that interesting? Very interesting. Now plug into that, Jenny.
Prophecy of that.
Your observation. Yeah.
That prophecy was 300 years earlier.
Exactly right. Yeah. That their bones would be burned upon their altar.
By Josiah.
Yeah, these are ones who are already dead, and he's gotten their bones wherever he
I would think so. Men. Yes. Yes. Some have suggested that these, and in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, I've forgotten the previous prophecy in 1 Kings 13, if it mentions specifically the bones of the priest. Check that for me and see if it mentions specifically the bones
sacrifice
of the priest.
Sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, and human bones shall be burned on you.
Okay. So it would be both.
And when he says sacrifice the priest, does that mean he killed them?
Well, yeah, but then they'd be burned, likely, upon the altar.
But I mean,
yeah.
He didn't just go dig up old bones necessarily.
I don't know how detailed that was. I don't know. I'm not sure there's really anything but speculation to find out. But he desecrated the altar, and it was prophesied by the young prophet that Josiah would do that 300 plus years before. And so that's helpful. You know, when somebody reads the Bible and says, oh, it's just a book of myths, how do you get all this stuff right? How do you get it right? And, you know, we might say, well, you know, there's just one or two things that might be presumed to be right. But when you compound that by how many things were prophesied in detail, I don't know how you could say it is anything other than inspired. And therefore, it's much, much worthy of your study. Well, at 26 years old, when he rebuilt the temple, part of that was to keep the Passover. And he did so. And we talked about this at the conclusion of our study Wednesday night, that, that he observed the Passover in the greatest way since it had been observed during the days of Samuel the prophet. And the question was asked, well, does that mean that the Passover really had not been observed or not been observed to this magnitude? And I would prefer to think that it had not been observed to this magnitude. And the reason is when we see just what was done. And I believe John was it you that suggested that we have, or maybe Chris, over 40,000 animals that were offered in the observance of this Passover. And so you see the magnitude of the observance by King Josiah that he has instituted. Now, when you think further about Josiah, we didn't talk about this. We got right down to the tail end of our study and ran out of time. But in 2 Chronicles chapter 35, 2 Chronicles chapter 35, if you'll pick up the reading there about verse 20, and let's see, I need a good reader. Chris, would you mind to read this for me, please? Verse 20 through verse 30. Yes, chapter 35, verse 20 through verse 27. Why don't you read through verse 27? Yeah, that's a misprint on my chart. Sorry.
After all this, when Josiah set the temple in order, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to make war at Carchemish on the Euphrates, and Josiah went out to engage him. But Necho sent messengers to him, saying, "What have we to do with each other, O king of Judah? I'm not coming against you today, but against the house with which I'm at war, and God has ordered me to hurry. Stop for your own sake from interfering with God who is with me, that he may not destroy you." However, Josiah would not turn away from him, but disguised himself in order to make war with him. Nor did he listen to the words of Necho from the mouth of God, but came to make war in the plain of Megiddo. And the archers shot King Josiah, and the king said to his servants, "Take me away, for I am badly wounded." So his servants took him out of the chariot and carried him in the second chariot that he had, and brought him to Jerusalem. He died and was buried in the tombs of his fathers, and all Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah. And Jeremiah chanted a lament for Josiah, and all the male and female singers speak about Josiah in their lamentations to this day. And they made them an ordinance in Israel. Behold, they are also written in the lamentations. Now the rest of the acts of Josiah, his deeds of devotion, as written in the law of the Lord, and his acts from first to last, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah.
Thank you. In the reading of this text, we see that Josiah engaged the king of Egypt in battle. Now, we had some discussion a little bit Wednesday night about whether or not, in fact, God had spoken to the Pharaoh about engaging these of Syria. And the point is, he claimed to. I don't know. It says that he did. It says these words were commanded of God. Whether God had communicated with Necho, king of Egypt, or not, might be open to some discussion. But the point is, that, and the point we want to see, is that Josiah was killed. And when Josiah was killed, there was great lamentation for him because of the good things that he had done. Josiah was a good king. And when we read about Josiah and the 31 years that he reigned and see all of the good that he accomplished from a very young age, what we want to note is that with all of the reforms that Josiah was able to put in place, it did not remove the consequences of the sins of the people that they had committed prior to this. Now, we've hammered that, I think, before, I'm not so sure sufficiently, but when we think about sin and we think about reforms, reform does not necessarily mean repentance. Reform involves a change, but not necessarily for the right reasons. I think when we look at Josiah's reforms, they were at least in his heart for the right reasons. But that does not necessitate that the people changed their heart. They're doing exactly what Josiah would have them to do, But look at what their predecessors have done. Are there no consequences to what their predecessors have done? Look, if you will, in 2 Kings chapter 23. 2 Kings in the account here in chapter 23, reading beginning at verse 25. 23:25. It says, "And like unto him, there was no king before him that turned to Jehovah with all his heart, and with all his soul, and with all his might, according to the law of Moses. Neither after him arose there any like him." Who are we reading about? Josiah was a very good king. But as you read at verse 26, "Notwithstanding, Jehovah turned not from the fierceness of his great wrath, wherewith his anger was kindled against Judah, because of all the provocations wherewith Manasseh had provoked him. And Jehovah said, I will remove Judah also out of my sight, as I have removed Israel. And I will cast off this city which I have chosen, even Jerusalem, and the house of which I said, my name shall be there." Now when you pick up the reading beginning at verse 1 of chapter 24, it says, "In his days Nebuchadnezzar king of Babylon came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years." Now we're reading about the successor of Josiah, Jehoiakim. "And he became the servant of Nebuchadnezzar king of Babylon for 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him, and Jehovah sent against him the bands of the Chaldeans, and the bands of the Syrians, and the bands of the Moabites, and the bands of the children of Ammon, and sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of Jehovah which he spake by his servants the prophets." Judah is going to be destroyed. Jerusalem will fall. Josiah can't help that. And it's because of the rebellion, sometimes of predecessors, that consequences are imposed upon this generation and sometimes generations thereafter. Judah's destruction was declared to be because of the sins of Manasseh. Jeremiah made that plain in chapter 15 and in verse 4. Now, if we don't see that, we need to back up and latch on to that again. We talked about how that the thief on the cross was saved by the Lord. As the Lord said, "This day thou shalt be with me in paradise." Was he forgiven of his sin? Yes. Did he still die the death of a thief? He surely did. Yes. When Paul had been arrested, a part of his defense was, and I quote, "If I had done anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die." Did Paul understand that the things that he had done, perhaps in times gone by, the consequences could very well mean the penalty of death? Yes. Was he willing to accept that penalty? Yes. Was he forgiven? Yes. But it did not remove temporal consequences. And he was willing to accept those. When we look at the prodigal son, I think another classic example, and I use these frequently because I want you to remember this point. When you think of the prodigal son who came to his father in Luke 15 and demanded his inheritance right now, and his father called in the two boys and he gave the younger his inheritance, and the text tells us he went into a far country and he lived it up in riotous living. And then when there came a famine, he was hungry and nobody helped him. And he remembered, interesting point, he remembered what it was like to be at home. How that even the servants had bread enough and to spare. And he said, "I will arise and I'll go to my father and I'll tell him, and you're familiar with that, I've sinned against heaven and in thy sight. No more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of the hired servants." And his father ordered that the fatted calf be killed, and they began to make merry and everything was good. But the older brother would not go in. And when the father began to plead with the older brother to rejoice, he said, "This my son was dead, now he's alive again. Well, what's your problem?" He said, "All that I have is thine." What about that younger brother? Was he going to get any more inheritance? No. He had his and he used it up. Was he forgiven? Yes, he was forgiven, but there were consequences to what he did. And I think sometimes we get mixed up on that. We think that forgiveness equals no consequence. And that's not the same. That's just not true. We've got to get that firmly fixed in our mind. We see that illustrated here with the life of Josiah. Now things are beginning to go south for the people of God, the people of Judah. And if you'll note, once again, I'll pass through this quickly because we've talked about Hezekiah already and the place, the special place that he holds in this history as a turning point among the kings. But as we talk then about the son of Josiah, Jehoahaz, also called Joahaz, also called Shalom in Jeremiah chapter 22 and verse 11. So when you run across that name, be aware in the account of the kings, you're reading about the same man, Jehoahaz. Okay? Now as we talk about Jehoahaz, let's go back to the account of the kings. In 2 Kings chapter 23, beginning in verse 31. 2 Kings 23, beginning in verse 31. Very simply stated, he was 23 years when he began to reign. We note that he reigned only 3 months in Jerusalem. In verse 32, he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah according to all that his fathers had done. Interesting observation. When we read about King Josiah, and now we read about Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, we see that he's very wicked and Josiah was very good. How do you explain that? We've read about this before, have we not? As we talked about Manasseh. And we noted that Manasseh was the son of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, one of the good kings, expressed great confidence in God to preserve he and the city of Jerusalem from the onslaught of the Assyrian king. But then Hezekiah had a son that was one of the most wicked kings of the southern kingdom. And now we've got Josiah, perhaps the best of the kings of the southern kingdom, and he has a son, Jehoahaz, who's one of the worst. How do you explain that?
I was going to say that one of the things I think about is that when we look at the situation with Rehoboam way back at the beginning of the southern kingdom, He counseled with the elders that had been with his dad, but he took the advice of the people with whom he grew up. I think there was probably it's kind of like today, people that you know live in luxury and you know they're the you know all they do for their life is to just do whatever they please mm-hmm. type thing. They have a tendency to grow up thinking that the world owes them everything. And maybe that's what's with the king here. He's thinking, well, even though my dad's a you know great king and worships God, we realize that there are people in the church today who have grown up in spiritual families and they've fallen away because they wanted to do it their way.
Yeah.
And I think these two kings wanted to do it their way.
There's all kinds of influences. The influence of other people, the influence of contemporaries, the influence of the world generally, but we can't minimize one's own will. We all grow up in sometimes rather unique environments. But the point is, you know, somebody said, well, I'm an alcoholic because my dad was an alcoholic, or I was raised in a home that was divided, and therefore, you know, I have problems in my home. I came from a bad side of town, and so that's been my environment. Lots of bad people live on my street, and that's why I do what I do. Do we not find that God's people, in whatever environment they are in, are to rise above the environment and serve the Lord? And you're not the exception. This has always been true. And Jehoahaz doesn't have an excuse to say, well, you know, I live among some contemporary folks that are very wicked, therefore I can disregard the will of God, and I can disregard the will of my father, Josiah. No, there are consequences to the choices that you make, whether they be good or bad. That's up to you. You're to rise above the environment. Now, someone might say, well, so-and-so had advantages that I didn't have. So be it. Does that change the standard? Does that lower the bar for you? No, it does not. Now we know in verse 3 of our text, that says verse 3, that should not be verse 3, that should be verse 33. That's another typo, I apologize. Verse 33, it says that Pharaoh Necho put him in bonds in Riblah, in the land of Hamath. that he might not reign in Jerusalem. And he put the land to a tribute of 100 talents of silver and 1 talent of gold. And Pharaoh made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the room of Josiah, his father, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. And he took Jehoahaz away, and he came to Egypt and died there. Now, that's the end of Jehoahaz. But I want to make this observation. Josiah has 3 sons that serve as king in Judah. Now, make a note of that. If you're looking at your charts on page 116, 117, notice the sons of Josiah. One is Jehoahaz that reigned for only 3 months. We just talked about him. Another son of Josiah was Jehoiakim, or Eliakim, as his name is called. And another son, skip one, Jehoiachin or Coniah, on your page and drop down to Zedekiah. And you'll note that Zedekiah was yet another son of Josiah that sat on the throne in Judah. Now, make sure you've got that labeled somewhere, so when we come to that, you'll know that we're reading about the sons of Josiah. And let's see what they did. You'll note that it was not just Jehoahaz that was an evil king. But as we flip the page just a little, you'll notice that Jehoiakim was not a good king either. Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, brother of Jehoahaz, now serving as king of the southern kingdom. What did he do? Look at the account beginning in verse 34. We noted that Eliakim is appointed by Pharaoh Necho. What authority does the king of Egypt have to appoint a king in Judah? Randy?
Well, he's the one who killed Josiah.
Okay.
So that kind of makes Egypt in charge.
Yes.
Because they killed the king.
Yes.
And that means they're running the show.
He didn't like his brother.
No.
So now you're going to be king.
So Pharaoh gets to choose his.
Okay, that's what he does.
Just to get it straight, can you go back one turn? Josiah's sons are Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah.
That's correct.
And Jehoiachin is the son of Jehoiakim.
That's correct.
Okay.
All right. So I think the Pharaoh killed Josiah, but then Jehoahaz was made king by the people, right?
Right. So whatever authority he has, it's not God-given authority to appoint kings. But that is interesting. I wanted to make that point in passing. When we talk about Jehoiakim, look at what he did to the people of Judah. He taxed them heavily. And who collects the taxes?
Pharaoh.
He gets them. But whose job is it to bring it all in? The king, Jehoiakim. Yeah. So Jehoiakim is bringing this money in and giving it to Pharaoh. How'd you like to be a citizen in Judah at this point? The king has been appointed by Pharaoh. The king is over you, and he collects taxes from you and gives it to the king. And then Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, drop down to chapter 24. Beginning in verse 1, in his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him. And Jehovah sent against him bands of the Chaldeans and bands of the Syrians and bands of the Moabites and bands of the children of Ammon, and sent them against Judah to destroy it according to the word of Jehovah, which he spake by his servants, the prophets. We saw that earlier in verse 27 of the preceding chapter. In verse 3 it says, surely it, at the commandment of Jehovah came this upon Judah to remove them out of his sight for the sins of Manasseh according to all that he did, and also for the innocent blood that he shed. For he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood. Now, when we talked about Manasseh, what do you remember that he did? Really a bad king. What did he do?
Sacrificed
He sacrificed the children. Some of them he offered to the god Molech. Now we've talked about how that was accomplished. You heat that thing up and you throw the kids into a hot red pan and cook them. Now, that's what Manasseh did in worship to these idols. Now you'll note that Nebuchadnezzar comes up and he takes vengeance as the instrument of God, much like the Assyrians were the instrument of God because of the disobedience of these people. And then in verse 5 it says, "Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiachin, his son, reigned in his stead." Before we leave Jehoiakim, there's just a whole lot of stuff that we need to talk about. Jehoiakim was not a good king. Not a good king. In fact, as you'll turn over to the account of Jeremiah. Now remember, Jeremiah was one of the prophets during this period of time in the history of God's people. And there's several things in Jeremiah, perhaps that might be interesting and very helpful to us in our study. If you'll note the time frame identified by Jeremiah himself, Randy, would you read for me verses 1, 2, and 3? Of Jeremiah chapter 1, I'm sorry. Jeremiah chapter 1, verses 1, 2, and 3. We're not there yet, but we're going.
Jeremiah 1, 1 through 3?
Yes, please.
The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests who were in Anathoth, in the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of the Lord came in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign. It came also in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, until the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, son of Josiah, king of Judah, until the exile of Jerusalem in the 5th month.
All right, that's informative. It tells us when Jeremiah was a prophet. He prophesied during the days of Josiah and during the time of his sons, right on up until the time that Babylon took them captive. Now, Jeremiah then would be a good place to look to see what kind of conditions existed in Judah, wouldn't it? So as we look in the book of Jeremiah, notice, if you will, beginning in verse 5. The writer says, "Thus saith the Lord," or Jehovah, "what unrighteousness have your fathers found in me?" Chapter 2. Got to ask that. I'm sorry. Chapter 2, verse 5. Jeremiah, chapter 2, verse 5. "Thus saith Jehovah, what unrighteousness have your fathers found in me, that they are gone far from me, and have walked after vanity, and are become vain?" Jeremiah says, what did I do? What did God do to cause you to do that? Well, what is it that they have done? In verse 13, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewn them out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water." Now, Jeremiah is very pointed. They've forsaken the Lord, but they place their trust in others that can't help them. Do you see that? What else have they done? In verse 17, "Hast thou not procured this unto thyself, in that thou hast forsaken Jehovah thy God, when he led thee by the way?" And he talks about him coming up out of Egypt and so forth and so on. God led you, and what did you do? You left him. And then in verse 19, once again, "that thou hast forsaken Jehovah thy God, and that my fear is not in thee, saith Lord Jehovah of hosts." Becomes apparent they have forsaken God. But then in chapter 2, if you'll drop down in that context to verse 32, he says, "Can a virgin forget her ornaments, or a bride her attire? Yet my people have forgotten me days without number." Ladies, you forget what your wedding dress looks like? Some of you have been married for quite some time.
What chapter
was it? That was in chapter 3. No, chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 32. You still remember what your wedding dress looked like? See, brides don't forget that. But yet God says, "You've forgotten me days without number. You don't remember what I've done. You don't remember the blessings You don't remember the curses. You don't remember anything. You've forsaken me. You've forgotten me. And then as you turn to chapter 6, I'm sorry, let's back up one or two others before I get to chapter 6. Look at chapter 4 of Jeremiah. In verse 22, Jeremiah 4, verse 22, he says, "For my people are foolish. They know me not. They are sottish children. They have no understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good, they have no knowledge." Now, we might paraphrase that statement. What would we call them? They don't have any knowledge. Don't have any understanding.
Fools.
Yeah. They're just fools. Now, in verse 19 of chapter 5, he said, "And it came to pass, when ye shall say, Wherefore hath Jehovah our God done all these things unto us? Then shalt thou say unto them, Like as ye have forsaken me and served foreign gods in your land, so shall ye serve strangers in a land that is not yours." What's Jeremiah telling them? You're going to be taken captive. Yes, sir. Now, when you drop down into the 5th chapter to verse 30, Jeremiah 5, verse 30, look at your Bibles. It says, "A wonderful and horrible thing has come to pass in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests bear rule by their means. And the people, my people, love to have it so. And what will ye do in the end thereof?" Who was leading the people? Well, the prophets and the priests. They had lots of them. But what were the prophets and the priests doing?
Whatever they wanted.
Exactly right. Whatever they wanted. The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests bear rule by their means. In other words, they preach to the highest bidder. Whatever benefits me the most, that's what I'll tell you. Now, you think folks don't do that today? Back in Arkansas, where I used to live, a little town of Piggott, about 3,800 people, back in the 1960s, there was a large congregation in that little town until what we sometimes come to think of the issues hit. We think about institutionalism, sponsoring church arrangement, and the social gospel in general. And one preacher that was preaching for them said that he knew where he was going to stand because he knew how to do two things. He knew how to farm and he knew how to preach, and he didn't aim to farm. Now, what does that tell you, beloved?
Do whatever
it takes to preach. Yeah. All where the money is, you see. Kind of sounds like the shepherds that Jesus talked about who are hirelings. When the flock's in trouble, I'll run out. Now that's what was existing during the time of King Jehoiakim. The people loved to have it so. You say, well, how did it ever get that bad? Well, I want you to look at chapter 6 and we can see a pattern developing. How did it get to be so bad? In verse 10, the prophet says, "To whom shall I speak and testify that they may hear? Behold, their ear is uncircumcised, and they cannot hearken. Behold, the word of Jehovah is become unto them a reproach. They have no delight in it." You ever get to the point where reading God's word just kind of seems to be like something else you feel like you have to do? You see, the word was taught, but they didn't enjoy hearing it. They didn't enjoy studying it. They had no delight in it. And so it had become a reproach to them. Why in the world would I want to come in the audience of some prophet like Jeremiah and listen to all his words telling me how wrong I am? Why would I want to do that?
To correct yourself.
No, I don't want to do that. That's insulting to me. I don't want to hear it. And that was their attitude. You see, they had ears, but their ears had become uncircumcised. They wouldn't listen. You see, the problem was not that God was not speaking, but He was not speaking through these false prophets. He was speaking to them, but they had no desire to hear. Now, when you look at verse 13, you see the second step involved in how they progressed to get to this point that we're going to be talking about.
Which
chapter 6 still, verse 13. Thank you for asking, by the way. Keep me on track. It says, "For from the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is given to covetousness, and from the prophet even unto the priest, everyone dealeth falsely." Are you going to be doing right when you have this kind of leadership? What becomes the motive? Covetousness. Whatever makes it good for me, you see, I don't care about you. And so the priests and the prophets were willing to sell themselves, as we said, to the highest bidder. And then in verse 14, what were they saying? Verse 14, "They have healed also the hurt of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace." Well, what was the prophet Jeremiah telling them? You better get ready. Destruction is coming. What were the false prophets telling them?
We're good.
You don't have to worry about anything. We're all good. Everything's fine. Now hold your finger there. We're not done with chapter 6. And jump over, if you will, to chapter 23. Chapter 23. Let's see what these false prophets were doing. In chapter 23, beginning in verse 17, he says, "They say continually unto them that despise me, Jehovah has said, ye shall have peace." There it is. Peace, peace. But he said, "And unto everyone that walketh in the stubbornness of his own heart, they say, no evil shall come upon you." Now what were the false prophets telling them? You can do what you want to. Everything's good. God's not going to do anything about it. There's not going to be a day of judgment. You see, after all, this really isn't wrong. Or sometimes we hear the expression today, it isn't all that bad. Well, just how bad does it have to be that bad?
Or the song, "You can't be wrong when it feels so right."
Well, when it feels so good, you just can't be wrong. Yeah. And then in verse 21, look at it. Chapter 23, Jeremiah. He said, "I sent not these prophets, yet they ran. I spake not unto them, yet they prophesied." You see, here they are affirming what we have to say to you came from God. Now, you want to trust every preacher that stands before you? Do you want to trust everyone who professes to be an elder of God's people? Now, you think on that, beloved. These are serious things. That's what the prophets and the priests were by way of comparison to these people. That was their leadership. And the prophets and the priests told them what they wanted to hear, and they felt good about it. But what the prophets and the priests told them had caused them to forsake God. Now, what was God going to do about it? Bring judgment. He would forsake them. Okay? So we'll start with that next time. Didn't get done. So much to say in Jeremiah.